Welcome to the podcast Doing Girly Things, a podcast focused on making construction, working in the field, wearing a hard hat a girly thing to do. Every other Monday, a new episode will be released. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, please see the show notes for how to get involved. For a free sticker, leave a review on Apple Podcasts and send a screenshot of your review to Doing Girly Things Instagram, and we'll send you a free sticker for your hard hat. Lastly, follow the podcast on Instagram for all the updates and hilarious reels to keep us all sane throughout the work week. Happy building, and you got this. Thank you for coming to the podcast, Tina. She is the co-founder and the owner of the Folsom Group, a co-op and condo consulting company in New York City. So I'm very excited to have her on. Very excited to talk about efficiencies, condos, and all the work that she does. So season three of the podcast, we are talking about who is women in construction. And so I think it's very important that we talk about all the different career paths that you can go into and still be considered women in construction. So Tina, thank you for coming on to the podcast today. And so I know you guys work with existing buildings and reducing the operating costs, but that isn't what you've done your whole life. So can you start us off by talking about how you got to this spot of creating your own company?
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Megan, for having me. It's so exciting. I love your podcast, and you've done such a fantastic job. So how did I start? Well, I and my partner, we come from a financial services background. I have been analyzing companies for the sole purpose of investing my clients' money on Wall Street for over 20 years. And my partner got involved. He got elected to the board of his co-op. And in that, he basically threw me the financial statements and said to me, "If you are so good at analyzing this, can't you figure out how we save some money?" And I did what I did from Wall Street, my Wall Street background, which is I built a benchmark of various costs in order for me to know. Because, I mean, I don't know if $2,000 for service X is expensive or cheap. I don't know how much it's going to cost to replace a roof or repair the sidewalk. I mean, I had no idea. So I created a benchmark. I went to open houses of neighboring buildings in New York City. And I know my real estate friends are not too happy about me, but I pretended to be an owner or a buyer so that I could get the financial statements. And then I put all of the neighboring buildings or some of the neighboring buildings, I put them in a spreadsheet. And now I had a comparison. So now I knew that if one building was paying $2,000 in phone service per month, and the next building was paying $10,000. Now I knew that $10,000 was probably too much, right? And then I was out telling people about this, and every single person in New York that I met, they said, "Can I introduce you to my board?" Oh, so we saved $340,000 in the first 3 years for that building. And then I was out telling that story, that success story, to friends when I was out networking, and they all said, "Can I introduce you to my co-op board?" And I said to Mark, I went like, "You know, should we? It seems like there's a need for this." Yeah, so we formed our company. And in the beginning, it was basically, we weren't sure if it was going to work. So in the beginning, it was basically a side hustle while we were still running our financial services business. And then in 2019, this is now our main business.
So were people finding you then by just word of mouth?
Yes.
Yeah. So now for business, is it all word of mouth? People know that if they come to you, because you're mainly dealing with the overhead cost, is that?
Overhead and also constructions, which is how we ended up connecting, I think. So construction, the cost of construction is one of our very large, it's regular operating costs, but it's also the cost of construction. So all of these old buildings, they need new windows, they have leaky roofs, they have leaky facades, their sidewalks are crumbling, etc. So there's always construction when it comes to old buildings, and that's where we come in. we reduce how much they pay.
And so what exactly does consulting service mean? Like, if you were to explain it to somebody that was just going into career, what would you say overall, what is a consulting service like as a career?
So a consulting service is when you're an expert on one particular area. So when it comes to the co-op and condo industry, there's typically a board who is overseeing what and making all the decisions for the building. And then they hire a property manager who is then in charge of the day-to-day operation. But there's nobody really who consults them on their costs. So if, let's say that they need to replace the roof, then they typically will hire an engineer. The engineer will write out a scope and will typically come up with the engineering plans, and they will do the bidding. And then all the bidding, they bid it out to certain vendors or certain roof specialists. And then they'll have all of these different prices on the roof replacement as per the engineer's plan. Then what we do is that we know if the lowest bid is still too high or if we can actually bring in an alternative provider who can then reduce the cost of this roof replacement even further. And in some cases, we actually find that the scope, even if that's what the engineer really recommends, some of those things that an engineer recommends might not be within their budget. And if it's not necessary, we use our experts and we might be able to say, you know what, this particular one part of the scope that sounds very good, but you don't have to do that. I mean, that is not a safety issue. That is something that is you can do if you have the money. Since you don't have the money, we can take it out of the scope.
So do you work directly with the GC or do you work with the GC and the client then? And it's a typical contract structure, where do you typically fall in line?
So we work directly with the GC and we project manage. So even the GC typically project manages the project. We are a project manager on top of that, sort of. So we make sure that they actually show up. For you in construction, you know that contractors, they're very busy people. So they might show up, but they might not show up. We make sure that they show up. So we oversee the whole project, but we report to the board. I mean, the board hired us, so they're the ones that we report to. But they don't have to be CC'd on every single email and every single, all the admin work ahead of. When we plan the project, then we take care of all of that on the background and then we report back to the board and we say, okay, so this week we had all of these 900 emails. We don't tell them that, right? But here's the end result. This is what we accomplished this week. This is where we are. The AIA has been signed, is ready to be signed. The attorney did this. The GC did this. The engineer said this. And here's where we all are. And all you have to do is sign here.
And so what does a typical day look like? Like hours wise, are you on the project site? Are you typically sitting in meetings with the owner and the GC? Where do you typically for this career be kind of the consultant between the two groups?
Yeah, we are everywhere. So we work primarily from our office by our desk. But we also do go to sites. So we also wear hard hats and we are there to make sure that things, at least in the kickoff area, but if we're assigned a GC project manager, then as long as we have a good report with that particular GC PM, then we rely on them being on sites in some the technical part of it is not our expertise. The part of our expertise is to consult on the price and to make it happen, to get it done.
So if someone had like a skill set, so I'm hearing from you really like your good skill set is finding patterns and being able to find areas where you can compare costs. What would you say is like whenever you were younger is a skill that you had that really translates into what you do now as a career?
I've always been into statistics. And when I was in the financial services industry, I compared data. I mean, that is the skill set that I'm. And all another thing is that I have always, from when I was a kid, rejected status quo. I want to find a better way to do things. I do not want to accept that, well, this is always the way we've done it, and this is the way we do it. I'm like, no, there's going to be a better way.
What do you think the job you have now compares to what you thought you would be doing whenever you graduated? What do you think you would be doing?
This is actually my third career. So when I finished high school and did not go to college, and I wanted to be a hotel manager, and I was a hotel manager, or I was moving in that career direction for a long time. And then when I was, I think, 29, I went back to school. And I went to school for finance. I took my undergrad and my MBA. And then I worked on Wall Street. So, I mean, when I graduated high school, I wanted to be a hotel manager. And then I wanted to be a portfolio manager. And this is career number three.
And so what's your favorite part then about construction? And what makes you passionate to keep this as your main career now?
I am very passionate about this, and it's a completely underserved market. The niche that we operate in, it's really very underserved, and they need help. And so they're all volunteers. They don't have time for this. They are thrown into this volunteer position. And then they realize how much work it is in an industry that they don't know very much about. They have a full-time job and they have families and hobbies and all of these things that they do. So this is on top of all of this. And then they realize after starting that running a building is actually a very complicated thing. There are regulations, there are safety measures, there are building requirements. And then there's politics because it's everybody lives there and they don't like red roses in the lobby. They want white roses, right? And there are bed bugs and roaches and rats and roof leaks. It's really a very complex organization. And if you're in New York, the staff is union. There are so many complications, so it's really a very complex job, even though it is a volunteer position. So we really feel that they need help, and here we are. We're helping them.
So interesting to hear you talk about it, too, because so the majority of my adult life, I've been living on the West Coast. And so listening to you talk about boards and everything too, and I understand the housing market is completely different in New York City than what it is here in like Portland, Oregon or in Seattle. And so it's interesting to think too that there are these boards that, and so the way I'm understanding it is basically there's this group of people that operate the building. And so they are the people that tell you, you know, we're going to raise rent. We're going to, like you said, put red flowers in the lobby. And so then really what you're focusing on is whenever they need to do the construction aspect, these aren't people that know anything about construction, but yet they're set to make decisions that are, you know, tens, twenties, thousands of dollars. So that's where you come in to help. So what is typically then like the contract size that you guys are working with and helping buildings with, like typical building size?
So there are no typicals. Our smallest building that we have ever worked with had 5 units or 5 apartments. So it's a very small building. The largest one that we currently are working with is about 400 units. And anything in between, when it comes to projects that we work on, we have, if we do something as simple as a roof or facade replacement or repair, The smallest one we've ever worked was maybe 10,000 hours. And right now we're working one that is probably going to be at least 3 million. And the 3 million one, I mean, we're still in the planning stages and we're actually, the construction is starting next week if we get the building permits as we predict. And we have planning it. So we've been working with the engineers, selecting vendors, deciding on what should be done, working closely with the board on making decisions on what we need to do and how we need to do it. So that has been a long process, but now it's starting and it would probably take a year to complete.
I didn't even ask you, how big is your team?
So we are only two, but we have lots of partners and liaisons with many different vendors and professionals. And then when it comes to our marketing processes internal, we outsource to freelancers. So we have a bunch of freelancers who do some work for us.
And so it sounds like you've always worked in a male-dominated field, but hindsight 2020, what advice would you give someone about working in a male-dominated field?
You know, it's never bothered me. I like men. I like women. I don't really care. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, I understand that some people feel that they're minority. It's never bothered me.
I understand that. I went out somewhere with a friend and we walked in somewhere. She's like, you realize we're the only women in here right now. And I was like, honestly, if I recognized the only time I was the only woman, I would just like always be overwhelmed. Like, I don't even realize that anymore. And she's like, what do you mean you don't realize this? I was like, I really don't. I did not recognize till you said something that we were the only women in this room. And so what are your 10-year goals for the company?
So I don't have a 10-year goal. I have to come up with that. I have a 3-year goal and a 5-year goal. So my 3-year goal is to start working with a franchise developer. And the 5-year goal is to roll this out in all of North America as a franchise.
So start your company as a franchise so then you can come to places on the West Coast and other places to help them do the same exact thing that you're doing in New York.
Yes, but now that you ask for a 10-year, I guess in 10 years, then it would be that we will have a franchise all over the nation.
That is very cool. And so how much knowledge do you have then about like local energy code? Because I assume too, that whenever you say it, there's all these volunteers that are, you know, making construction decisions. And then you mentioned, you know, you have permits and you're hoping you get those back from the city, which I know exactly what that life is like. So typically, how much do people come to you and rely on you to know these different codes?
They do rely on us. Yeah. So energy codes, it's a hot topic. And in New York City, I'm sure it's the same in many other places. So in 2019, the state of New York came up with an energy code for the city of New York, where the goal is to take New York City carbon neutral by 2050. So they are going to start fining building if they do not meet this goal. And the way that they're doing that is in 2024, 20% of buildings that don't have the right, you know how there's an Energy Star portfolio manager where you input your energy use, and that's a national platform. And that is where 20% of buildings in New York will be fined in 2024. In 2030, so if nothing is done between now and 2030, then the fines increase. So we are seeing buildings that will be fined over 100,000. We have seen $1 million a year in fines for not meeting the greenhouse gas output. Now, between now and then, there's a few more years, so they do have time to retrofit the building before 2030. But 80% of buildings, as it stands right now, if they do nothing, will be fined in 2030.
So what is a typical construction project they would need to do? Like, is it replacing windows? Is it roofing? Like, what's a typical project that these condos need to do in order to fall within those energy guidelines?
So in our estimation, they need to replace their old boilers with electrifying the building. So right now we have a lot of buildings that still have boilers that use oil number 4, you know, the dirty oil, but even natural gas. And for decades, New York have tried to push buildings into converting to natural gas. Well, now with this new law, natural gas is no good. So they really have to electrify.
And are they purchasing carbon credits? Because I know that like in the data center realm, kind of what people are doing is they're purchasing offsets. Is that something that apartment complexes are having to do?
It's something where we have started looking into this, but it seems that it's so new that it's not really clear to anyone if that actually helps. So we actually have one building. So my partner's, because he's the board president, so he can, some of the stuff that we want to use for our company, he rolls it out in his building, and he's actually about to sign that building up for buying carbon credits so that we can see if it does make the desired change on that building's energy star scores. But we don't know. And all the professionals who sell these credits and all the people that we're talking, they don't really know.
Interesting. Whenever I went to your guys' website and I was taking a look around, I saw your guys' 2020 New York City Energy Code. And so I just typed that into Google because I was just curious as what it is. It's interesting because what you're saying is there is a lot of articles and a lot of debate about this new 2020 code that just came out and what it's going to do to existing buildings and finding places. So is that where you're seeing a lot of your business come in from then? Is from this new energy code?
Yes, it is. And very often that's not directly what they are working on, or maybe they heard something. I think that maybe one of the thing is that this just took them to being from feeling that they had everything under control to now they're just piling on even more. And these boards were just overwhelmed. And they said, listen, we have to start getting help.
And so they just need help understanding it too, because I can see too, even someone in construction, I have to deal with the city and everything and deal with all these energy codes. And we just ran into this issue up here, and they adopted the new energy code in Oregon as well. And with that, and I assume it's down there too, you have to actually meter every single load, if it's a receptacle, HVAC load, lighting. It really has made it so that way then everyone was kind of looking at us like, well, what do we do with this energy code? I don't know. Ask the engineer. The engineer was like, I don't know. I've never seen this energy code before. And we're like, I don't know. So here I am emailing like the state of Oregon person. And I'm like, hey, this is what we're doing. Does this meet within the guidelines? And then someone's like, we need to go refer to someone else because this code's so new. We don't know. And so it sounds like you guys are running into almost the same issues that I was running to, and this was just a simple adhering to the ASHRAE 90.1 standard. And it just, this whole standard is about how do you meter? And I think it really is important because you get to see where you're using excess energy. So you might be able to figure out that, you know, maybe the lobby area, you actually have a heater that's going bad. And so you're using twice as much energy this year as you were last year. And so you can kind of like help to find problems within buildings. But like you're saying too, is like a lot of these people that have access to that data or are making those decisions, they're just volunteers.
Yes. And think about it. So we're generally working with larger buildings. But think about all of these landlords that own rental buildings, and now they're not allowed to increase their rent. And they had this moratorium where they couldn't evict people who couldn't pay their rent. I mean, how can they operate? I mean, for them, their buildings is a business. I mean, they have all of these expenses, and then they have all the collections. And if they're not able to collect, and now We're going to be required to upgrade to adhere to all of these energy codes. I mean, where are they going to get their money from? So it's a really very difficult position for them. I don't see this as going very well. I mean, this is going to be a difficult one.
I think you're right. I think you do have a good niche too, because helping people make the smartest decision with every dollar that they have is going to be important too, because I'd be interested to see them side by side, New York City's versus Oregon and California's. I don't know who's going to be most different, but Tina, we are getting to the end of the episode, but before I let you go, I do want to play a little game with you. So I have these cards and they're called Best Self cards. And I really like to use them on the podcast because they just are a little deeper question. And it's just something that just asks you a question that I didn't think of, but I will give you two options.
Yes.
And you tell me which one you want to go with and then I'll read the question. So do you want dreams or life lessons?
Ooh, life lessons.
Life lessons. Okay. What piece of advice would you give your younger self if you could?
To start being a nice person much earlier. I think that I was so driven when I was young that I was so focused on getting to where I wanted to get. So I was not always as nice as I wished that I was when I was younger.
What really changed that for you? Was it someone pointing it out that it wasn't always a competition, or was it just you realizing that life was better if you were nicer?
I think I just realized. So during the financial crisis of 2008, 2009 was such a difficult time for us that I just slowed down. And I think I just realized that maybe it was from listening, meditating and reading and trying to become a better person and trying to calm down and it just humbled me. So I think it really changed how I acted.
Because you were working on Wall Street then.
I know.
Interesting. Yeah. So you were right there during the heart of all of 2008 on Wall Street.
It was scary. I mean, we thought that we were going to lose our apartment. We were losing clients, almost our business and all of our investments, our personal savings and investments. And we were not far away from losing our apartment. So it was very scary and it really humbled me.
Well, I think you are very nice as it is. And I am so happy to have the pleasure of having you on the podcast and speaking with you. And if anyone ever wanted to use your services or to talk with you to find out more about what you could offer, or they have questions about your career path, where can people find you?
They can find me. Our website is www.thefolsongroup.com. And Folson is not like Johnny Cash's or the big prison. It's Folson, as in Nancy. And I'm also very active on LinkedIn, and all my contact information is either on the website or on LinkedIn. My profile is Tina Larsson, that's LarssonLi on LinkedIn. And I look forward to hearing from everyone. Thank you so much, Megan, for having me.
You're welcome. And I'll link all of that below so you can find Tina, you can find her wonderful business. And yeah, she is a pleasure to follow on LinkedIn. So thank you, Tina.
Thank you
for coming on.
Have a great one, Megan.
You too.